have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife in Wisconsin. Couple of guests for you back. Our regular guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David's an extension wildlife specialist and professor. David, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Larry.
And it's good to see Jamie Knack as well. Jamie, an extension senior wildlife outreach specialist with a nice smile on her face this morning. Hi.
Nice to see you, Larry. Great to be back.
They are both, of course, affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Lots to talk about with them. We'll talk fall migration, the fall hunting seasons, and, of course, take your questions and comments. Maybe you've got a recent interesting sighting. Maybe you've got a photo to send. If you want to send a photo and a question, you can email it to ideas@wpr.org or just phone in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Let's start with fall migration. What are some of the species that are starting south early?
Yeah. I'll start out with that, and Jamie, please pipe up as you want. This is the annual fall migration when we've got maybe 400 bird species in the state of Wisconsin. About 85% of those species leave our state for the wintertime, so we don't have many resident birds up here in the wintertime. But, it's the usual assemblage of all of the warblers, a lot of the shorebirds, waterfowl will go south, what we call neotropical migrants. So those are birds that are down, they go down into the new tropics or the neotropics, Central America, South America. So again, the wood warblers, orioles, indigo buntings, all sorts of things like that. So, the swallows, swifts, nighthawks, all those types of birds go south. But we have bats that go south as well. And so we've got 8 bat species in the state of Wisconsin. 4 of those stay here and hibernate through the winter, and 4 of those leave and go further south where they're active most, if not all, of the year where insects are active. And most of the birds that are going south, they're also go south because the foods that they utilize or the foods that they use are just not readily available up here in the wintertime, primarily insects and a lot of the fruits and things like that. And I'll tell you a really quick story. Last week, I was out sailing through Lake Michigan, and we were about in the middle of the lake, maybe 8:30 in the morning. We were seeing a lot of monarch butterflies going through. And I looked, and I saw 2 that I thought were monarch butterflies fluttering. And turns out that they were 2 bats that were flying south at about 8:30 in the morning across the middle of Lake Michigan. So that was pretty cool to see that. Saw a yellow legs that was also flying through there. We saw a couple of loons out in the middle of the lake. So, it's a neat time of the year to get going. The warblers, for example, are a little bit more difficult to identify in the fall because they've got their fall plumage. They're not as brightly colored. The males aren't as brightly colored as they are in the spring when they're coming back up here to start establishing breeding territories and things like that. But it's a really fun time of year to be out. And it signifies just the change in the season.
Yeah, absolutely. Jamie, what are the last ones to migrate in the season or the latest ones?
Well, some of them are ones that are just real short distance migrants where you maybe don't consider them a migrant at all, but things like Eastern bluebirds or American robins, where they're going to move and have a pattern south just enough to where they can still get those resources, but not have the energy expenditures to do a long migration. So, David mentioned the monarchs. I was going to mention that as well. So they're in the process of migrating to Mexico. So keep your eyes out. I've had a pretty good summer with monarchs in the yard and in the prairie around the house. Another wildlife activities at this time of the year, snapping turtles should be hatching. So you can be on the lookout for, they're about the size of a 50-cent piece for the turtle hatchlings. And then also white-tailed deer, they're starting to shed their velvet. So you'll start to see them making rubs. And now would be a good time if you have some favorite fruit trees or ornamental trees around the house that you want to protect. Now's the time to do that as we head into the fall.
And, of course, as we head into the fall, we've got our hunting seasons. Fall hunting starts up. Maybe you could talk about the DNR app, Hunt Wild Wisconsin. It's a cool app.
Yeah, so there's a lot of great resources. One of the issues with recruitment for hunting is really finding places to go hunting. And I think it's more just lack of information sharing on where public properties are and how to access that information. So one way is through the Hunt Wild Wisconsin mobile app. And within, once you download that app, you can go in there and you can explore the various layers on the maps. But you can explore public, and of course, if you're hunting on private land, you can, you know, zoom into those areas that you're hunting on private land. Also gives you the opportunity to select the species that you're interested in and then add layers. So, for example, whether it's bear or waterfowl or turkeys, if you select the species, it will then add the layer of the management zones for that given species. So we use zones to manage species differently. So that's something that will just automatically come over the layer of the map that helps you understand what tags you would need or where your tags are viable for. And then you can also drop a waypoint and you can name it. You can also start a track. So if you're going to go in and scout in an area and you're just going to start walking, you could drop the start point for your track and let it capture your movements and plot that on the map. Or if you get deep into public country and you find a spot that really looks good, you can mark it with a waypoint. A couple other things that are on this app are locations for CWD sampling and then also for carcass disposal. So you can get a map of where those locations are in the state. And they have some really great podcasts, and they continue to add podcasts to this app. So whether you like to listen to a podcast while you're sitting in a tree stand or turkey hunting, or maybe on your way to and back home from a hunting trip, lots of great podcasts to take advantage of as well. So, but it really doesn't stop there. So that's one option. I was just going to pull out my notes here, but there's also, it's called F-Flight. And so if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and you type in F-Flight, you'll get to an interactive map. Now, this is not an app that goes on your phone. It's actually on the DNR's website. But it gives you, it shows you or helps you to locate young aspen and alder habitat. So specifically for grouse and woodcock. It also identifies the areas in the state that are stocked for public hunt, stocked with pheasants for public hunting. And then also public access dove fields, so fields that have been managed specifically for mourning doves, which is one of the species that the hunting season opened today, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, the state has voluntary public access or habitat incentive program areas as well. And these are funded through the Department of Ag or Department of Agriculture. And it basically gives landowners, private landowners, a financial incentive to open their properties year round to public hunting. And so you can also go onto the DNR's website, get into this VPA. You can use that for your keyword and look at where these properties are in location to your home or areas where you're going to be traveling to hunting. And then the same would be true for open enrolled lands within the MFL, the Managed Forest Law Program. Again, tax incentive for forestry owners who set aside or open their property, their private lands to public access. They receive a reduction in their annual taxes. And that too, you can go on to the DNR's website. And not just for hunting, but MFL open lands are for hunting, fishing, sightseeing, hiking, and cross-country skiing are the designated recreational activities. So, again, some great resources on the Wisconsin DNR's website for how to find these places, and then also the Hunt Wild app that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I see the DNR has the book on regulations is kind of all collapsed into one pamphlet, booklet, whatever.
Yeah, this is the second year that they've come out with one pamphlet for all the various seasons. And as a hunter and angler myself, it is really nice. to have it all in one place. And there are some new things. So for those of you that do hunt and trap and fish and so on, it's really important that you stay up to date on any changes. And there are some changes. This is the first year of the updated bear management zone structure. So the zone boundaries have changed a little bit. Waterfowl hunters have a new duck zone structure as well. And the state was able to pass a state waterfowl stamp fee increase, which went from $7 to $12 and provides some, it's been a long time since we've had a fee increase. And it's trying to catch up with inflation, but really critical dollars for habitat restoration and management. And so that you'll see a little change with that when you go to purchase your state waterfowl stamp.
David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. Questions for them or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. And if you got a photo, that'd be great too. I don't know if you guys can see our photos, but Pete in McWanigo emailed that he's been watching an albino sparrow, all-white sparrow, forage in his yard. Seems to be part of a flock, but I've noticed lately the little one seems to be doing his own thing more and more when the rest of the flock is flushed. He or she just sits back almost like it knows it stands out and should stay still. How rare is this mutation in house sparrows, and how often are they observed in the environment? Can he be leucistic yet all white? I don't think his true eye color is being picked up well with the camera.
Yeah, I looked at that picture, and it's hard to determine exactly what kind of sparrow it is when it is all white, but certainly it looks like a sparrow. If it is truly a house sparrow, which I'm assuming Pete sounds like he knows what he's talking about, and that white bird has been in a flock of house sparrows. So house sparrows are not native to the United States. So they're called house sparrows, or also called English sparrows. So they're not native to the United States. So there's no protection of those of that particular species. And frankly, we don't want them here because they're not native and they outcompete some of our. It does appear to be leucistic. Is that albino would, that animal would have, pink eyes. And if it was a mammal, it would have pink eyes and a pink nose. So the absence of the pink, then it's termed leucistic. And it would be leucistic because it's all white. But there's also pigment mutations where instead of it being all white, you might have patchiness, where the white would be mixed with the actual natural plumage of the bird or the mammal, and that would be called a piebald. So it's just a variation of leucistic plumage. So that particular bird looks leucistic, not albino. Obviously it's a mutation, it's a genetic mutation, and typically genetic mutations are not carried through from generation to generation, oftentimes because that genetic mutation is not beneficial to the survival of an individual. And if that occurs in enough individuals, it could potentially theoretically hurt the species. So, and again, because that bird is so white and stands out, it obviously is very, the ability for a predator to see that bird is great, much greater than a bird that would blend in with the camouflage of the environment. So who knows how long the bird's going to stay.
Yeah. Who knows how long that bird's going to stay that way. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. Christina Myshock, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. Great to have them with us today from UW Extension, the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology as well. Let's take some calls. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Gary in Ocano Falls will give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Great show. I have a couple questions. First, I was wondering when the hummingbirds start migrating south. And the second question was, we have a little shorebird. We got a 2-acre bonfire place. And it's not able to fly. So I don't know if it would be a newborn yet or if it was injured, but the poor little guy can't fly. He's like 3 inches tall. But anyhow, I'll take my questions off the air and thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling. So who wants to start here?
I'll take a stab at this. So, yeah, hummingbirds are starting to migrate. And a lot of the migrants we've talked about already earlier in the show, you might be seeing them in the northern part of the state, but perhaps in the southern part of the state, they're not quite down here yet. So, hummingbirds are starting to migrate, as are most of the other bird species. But depending on where you are in the state, you may or may not see a great influx of birds yet. So be patient. They'll be down here in the next week or two. Again, as they migrate, typically because they're going south, they'll typically migrate with a north wind, because that north wind pushes them along as a tailwind and they don't have to expend as much energy. So if we have bad weather or strong southerly winds, typically those birds or bats aren't migrating on that particular day or night because the winds just are adverse and not favorable to the direction they want to go. And I was having a little trouble hearing the second part of the question. I think he said something about a shorebird, possibly.
Yeah, that couldn't fly. A very small, about 3 inches high. Wondered if it was maybe too young to fly.
Yeah, it's a little late for birds to be at that point where they can't fly, especially if you're migrating. So it likely is an injured bird, and if he would like to get in touch with the wildlife rehabilitator in the area and see if they would be able to take that bird in and perhaps offer some advice on how to capture that bird. And if you just want to Google Wisconsin wildlife rehabilitators, there's a list of certified rehabilitators that you could maybe find in your typical area. Depending on the description, it sounds like it could be a sandpiper or some, we have a variety of sandpiper species in the state of Wisconsin. So that sounds like what it could be. The other option is just to let nature take its course and see what happens. But if you're interested and want to be active in trying to help the bird, I would look up a certified Wisconsin wildlife rehabilitator.
All right.
And we didn't get a chance to really ask him, but whether it looked like it had wing damage or leg damage with its legs. But one of the things would be to just observe the bird for a while too and see if you can figure out a little bit more. It's also quite possible that it was migrating and is just energy deficient and will maybe be there, rest, refuel, and will find its way on its own too. So it would be good to observe it for a little bit. And as David said, call a rehabilitator for some additional assistance.
Take another call. John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks. It sounded like some of the birds are following the food and not necessarily sort of intending to migrate, like there's this instinct that goes off in their head. Is that true, and is that kind of what's happening with the birds that don't migrate very far?
David, so typically
For animals that migrate or animals that hibernate as their strategy to survive the winter or whatever the case might be, that the large driver that drives the whole system is day length. And so as days lengthen in the springtime, as that occurs, then the weather warms up. We get different weather patterns. So typically the winds are coming more out of the south than they are of the north. We have more precipitation. It's warmer temperatures. And all of that then starts spawning other more refined cues, such as hatching out of insects or young being born of a variety of different species. So you have an influx of food on the landscape. The reverse of that in the fall is now we're having shortened day length. And that shortened day length starts cueing animals to say, if I need to go to sleep for the winter, I need to start gathering a lot of food and putting on a lot of fat to store so I can survive through the hibernation period. Or if I'm going to migrate out of here, I need to start really just being gluttonous and eating as much food as I can so that I can start storing some energy reserves and get ready to start moving south. And so what really the primary cue or the strongest driver is shortened day length. But with that comes a reduced amount of food availability, abundance, things of that nature. So the animals are moving in order to keep up with food resources, but the food is not the primary driver. It's actually the day length.
Give a call with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed that they have been feeding two sandhill cranes since before June. They come in every morning and late afternoon. The birds are coming in three times lately instead of just two. Are they getting ready for migration? And when will they leave, likely? Jamie, you want to take that?
Typically they will. So sandhill cranes are going to start staging. So they'll start gathering in big flocks along the Wisconsin River, in wetland areas and so on around the state. And for me, their migration is often closely timed with the deer hunting season. So I can tell you it's usually in November, and that's when you start to see them move further south. So, continuing to feed them is likely not to impact whether they migrate or not. Although I would say there's plenty of natural foods out there for them right now. And so it may be in their best interest to not habituate them to people and to an artificial food source. But again, their internal instincts are pretty strong that when it comes time to go join others in these staging areas, they will be doing that. But we're looking at end of October, early November, where that behavior is starting to happen.
But Jamie's absolutely right, I think, to maybe start reducing or eliminating the food source. We've had, both Jamie and I have had a number of people, call us in mid to late December saying that they still have hummingbirds at the feeder. And the reason they have hummingbirds at the feeder that late into the winter is because there's a food source there. So, yeah, I agree with Jamie. Remove the food source and let these animals, just let nature take its course and let them do what they're supposed to be doing.
David, I wanted to mention a little project that you've been involved in or would like to get involved in that relates to trapping small animals.
Yeah, so thank you, Larry. We've had a project going on here in the Madison area since about 2014 called the Urban Canid Project. So we live trap and radio collar coyotes and red foxes in the city of Madison. And one of the fascinating things that we found from this project is that coyotes and red foxes are able to coexist peacefully, both in the same space and the same time here, at least in the urban parts of Madison. And we suspect that's in other urban areas, but we just don't have any data to support that. But and the ability for coyotes and red foxes to coexist in the urban area is completely different than these two species in non-urban areas, where typically they will overlap, but coyotes will typically kill red foxes in order to limit competition. So what we think is happening here in Madison is that there's so much food on the landscape in terms of an abundance of rabbits and squirrels and rats and small mammals and things like that, that these animals can coexist because they can share that abundant resource. They don't have to compete for a limited resource. So in order to kind of start investigating that, we're going to begin this October trapping small mammals and sighting and re-sighting rabbits in people's yards inside the Beltline of Madison. So we've started to recruit landowners, but I want to put a call out. If people are interested in helping out on our project, and again, this is just if you're a landowner within the Beltline in the Madison area. But if you're willing to let us come out and trap small mammals on your residential property and re-sight rabbits on your property and through your neighborhood, if you would please get in touch with me via my email, which is ddrake2@wisc.edu. I'll put you in touch with my graduate student who's conducting the project, and it would be very, very helpful if we had access to residential private properties in Madison. So thank you very much for the ability to plug that, Larry.
Yeah, so ddrake2@wisc.edu.
Yeah, or if you want to Google David Drake and the University of Wisconsin, my contact information should come up that way too, if that's easier.
All right.
David,
well,
David, yeah. Do you want to maybe explain what you mean by re-sight rabbits? I'm not sure that came across. And then maybe also what size small mammals. You're probably not helping people with skunks and raccoons and nuisance wildlife. But
not at all. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get a sense about the types have an abundance of small mammals. So anything from really a shrew all the way up to, you know, squirrels, rats, things like that. And then for rabbits, we're going to essentially be doing a kind of a spotlight technique where we're going to drive through neighborhoods and around yards and just spotlight rabbits at night. So so that's really, and I shouldn't say it's not the entire composite of small mammals in Madison. It's going to be a kind of select group of small mammals. But because Madison's primarily privately owned, we need access to that private land. And if people are willing to let us come onto the property, and we're happy to answer questions and show you what we're going to do. And we'd love to have the collaboration of the private landowners in Madison, if that's possible.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's take another call. Ellen in Oak Creek. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. Great show. I'd like to, we do bird watching and bird feeding, and we saw a European goldfinch. I was able to identify it by its markings, and it comes and it goes. It'll be here and it'll feed on our thistle feeder for like a couple of days, and then it disappears, and then it'll be back like a week later. I was just wondering, will it stay here for the winter, or is it going to take off?
Hmm. Jamie, you want to?
Yeah. I have to be, so I am not very familiar with the distribution abundance of the European goldfinch. I would have to do some digging myself, but I can point you to the resource I would use, and that is to go into All About Birds. So Cornell Lab of Ornithology is a great resource for lots of things related to birds, from nest boxes to cameras. So they've got live cameras on nestlings or in nest boxes going on, but also they have a page that's called All About Birds. And if you went in there and clicked on or typed in the search box, European goldfinch or American goldfinch, you could get some more additional information readily. So it'll talk about how to identify the species, look-alike species, range maps, and so on. And that's where I would be headed. The other option is to go into Wisconsin eBird and type in the species there too and search and see if there have been other reports in your area. And so without being able to do that quickly on air, that's where I would point you to get that answer.
Yeah, the other thing, I think all good suggestions, Jamie. The other thing I would suggest is European goldfinches are commonly bred as pets. And I'm guessing, because we are not in the European goldfinch range here in America at all, so I'm assuming that somebody had that bird as a pet and it got and it escaped. So what you might want to do is either, you know, a lot of people use this app called Nextdoor, and if you're on the Nextdoor app and you have that app, that Nextdoor communication ability for your neighborhood, you might want to just put out a call through the Nextdoor app or Facebook for your neighborhood that the European goldfinch has been seen here, and see if somebody claims it as their pet.
Oh. Yeah, another good idea. And it gives me a good excuse to promote the fact that Bill Volkert will be on next Wednesday, and he'll be talking, of course, all about birds for the whole show. So that's next Wednesday here on the Ideas Network on the show. And just to continue that part of it, Scott Craven, as long as we're talking about birds, Scott Craven will be presenting a program about birds of Wisconsin this coming Saturday. Jamie, you want to mention that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So there is a new bird store in Greendale, which is just a little south of Milwaukee, and it's called The Nest. And for those of you familiar with that area, it's in the historic Greendale Hose Tower building. And so they have an event called Feathered Facts Seminar this Saturday from 10 to noon. And Scott's going to be there. He's going to be talking about the diversity, biology, and behavior of birds, as well as human interactions with them. And so if this is something you'd be interested to go and check out the new store and hear what Scott has to say, they are asking that you register ahead of time. And to do that, you can just Google their website. It's nestofbirds.com. And when you get to their website, click on events, and there'll be a quick information you need to put in your information to register, and then you print that confirmation email, and it's your ticket in to that seminar. And they're closely monitoring how many people are coming in. So only those with a confirmation will be admitted. And again, it's in Greendale, and it's from 10 o'clock until noon this Saturday, September 4th.
And we have a link on our page as well, the Larry Mueller Show page, under our program notes for today's date. So that's another spot to get that. But that should be fun. Scott's going to be blabbering on for 2 hours. I love it. Well, on that note, let's take another call. Mary in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Mary. Whoop, we lost Mary. All right, well, let's go to Elizabeth in Columbia County then. Hi, Elizabeth. Oh, we lost a couple of people here. We've had a little trouble with our phones, so we'll... we won't discourage you at all. We encourage you to give a call and let's see what happens. With your own questions, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, gee, that photo that we got from Pete in McGuanago of the leucistic sparrow was a great photo. If you have a photo, maybe you want to have an identification made of the bird, or just for fun for us to see and comment on, I hope you'll do that as well. And let's see now if we got Mary there in La Crosse. Mary, hi.
I'm here. I was chuckling about Scott Craven, and I somehow got cut off. But I do have a sparrow question, and I'll tell you what my question is and then why. Is there a bulletin about sparrows that specifically talks about them being a nuisance bird? Last July, I moved into a small senior citizen complex here in La Crosse, and nobody had been feeding the birds at all, and one apartment started feeding the birds outside of their window, but they were using that using that really, really, really cheap seed, and so they have just been getting sparrows. And there's a row of shrubs alongside of our building, and last spring they were full of sparrow nests, and the population has increased so that when they're perching, the whole length of the building is one big long row of sparrows, and they kind of make a mess in our little patio area. And I had contacted our management and asked if they could talk to her about discontinuing that seed, and then for the winter, and then next spring, just starting to use chipped sunflower seed. And I was told that because we are an independent living apartment, that we don't have any right to control what they
other people,
do.
Yeah, what other people are doing. So suggestions there, some ideas for her.
Sure. Mary, I think you have a really good handle on what the problem is. Those commercial mixes are favored by some less desirable species. So, and I think you made the right step talking to the building manager and trying to go at it that way. I certainly understand the response that they provided you as well. I'm wondering how comfortable you would feel knocking on the door or talking with your neighbor and sharing that information, because he obviously loves birds, enjoys feeding. And if you could approach it with either, there's a bird feeding publication that David and I and Scott Craven wrote on bird feeding tips. We could maybe provide you with a copy of that. Maybe you could bring a small bag of black oil sunflower seeds and have a conversation with her about, you know, the additional diversity of birds she could attract if she was more selective with the feed, and that you just share some of the knowledge that you have in feeding birds and enjoying wild birds. She may not even realize that these house sparrows are exotic and not really desirable for a lot of the reasons you've mentioned, as they can kind of take over and make a mess. So yeah, that would be my suggestion. That I think that might go over pretty well.
And then you get a chance to see maybe the cardinal or, you know, especially other birds. That person may enjoy seeing something other than just sparrows all the time. So that's a real benefit to the person who's doing the feeding. Well, good luck with that, Mary. Appreciate your call very much. George in Ashland County, it's your turn now. Hi, George.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about what are the consequences for the birds and other wildlife of large forest fires like the Greenwood Fire up in northern Minnesota, and even the smoke from the numerous wildfires up in above the Canadian border.
Yeah.
David, I'll start off, and Jamie, again, please jump in. You know, the problem with those wildfires is they're so destructive, and there's no regulation or no control of that fire. So prescribed fire is a wildlife habitat management technique that's very cost-effective, very efficient. It's very commonly used in areas where it can be applied, where you don't have a lot of houses around or you don't have to worry about smoke and people's respiratory issues and things like that. And prescribed fire is a low burning, kind of slow burning fire that goes along really the ground cover. It will also control some undesirable trees or woody vegetation type species and things like that. So you can really kind of clear out some undesirable vegetation. And the nice thing about prescribed fires is that it allows new growth to be promoted and come up. And that is really beneficial, not only because you have a very lush growth that provides a lot of cover for small mammals and birds and reptiles and amphibians, but that new growth is also very nutritious because it's got a lot of nutrients coming up from the ground, from the root system. The problem with these wildfires is it just takes out everything. And so from the ground up, especially if those fires get into the crown or the tops of the trees, then obviously it burns the entire tree down. Because it's out of control, it runs over civilizations and you know, communities and things like that. Ultimately, though, the fires are good, typically, in the balance of things, the fires are good for the habitat because it does get rid of a lot of old growth and it allows then promotes new growth to come up. But there are winners and there are losers. So, you know, species that require old growth vegetation, when you have none of that, they have no place to live. But you do promote species that require, young growth, not a lot of tall vegetation and things like that. So in the long run, it can be a good thing, but it takes years to recover. And it does certainly upset the balance of the types of wildlife that are there. So, and Jamie, I'm sure you've got some things you might want to add to that too.
We're not hearing Jamie here. Tell you what, I'll have Jamie ponder I'll have Jamie ponder that. And in the meantime, I will remind you that you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both within the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology as well at the UW-Madison. So it's great to have them with us. I think we got, Jamie, we got your voice back?
I think so. I have no idea what happened. I was just going to add that, you know, wildlife, their populations are pretty resilient, but the magnitude of these fires certainly can have a greater impact. Larger home range species that have the ability to either fly or move out of the area will have less issues with the fire, but it's the small mammals, the small reptiles and amphibians that could be impacted even greater. And I'm not real familiar with the area and the threatened and endangered species, but that's where the greatest impact can be, is if you have remnant populations or small populations of threatened and endangered species within that fire area, where you could really have some catastrophic loss from a species level. So,
yeah.
But otherwise, all the things David mentioned and talked about, you know, long term, it's going to take years and decades for that ecosystem to recover, but it'll flourish again.
But unfortunately, this may also be a time to just mention that the climate scientists are predicting that we're going to see more of these types of fires in terms of the magnitude is going to be greater and the frequency is going to be greater simply because the climate's warming. So, you know, it's unfortunately, this is going to be more common than uncommon.
A new reality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's take another call. Dave in Madison, I believe it's your turn. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have sisters that live in the Burlington, Wisconsin area, and they love to feed their birds. But about a month or so ago, they were told that there was some kind of infection going around, and they were being advised to take down all their feeders, which they did. But they weren't very clear what kind of infection it was. I don't know if they were sure. I'm not sure if you have any additional information on that.
Sure. Jamie, do you want to pipe in?
Sure. Thank you very much for the call, Dave. That was something I was hoping to mention today on the show. I recently had a conversation with a Wisconsin DNR wildlife health biologist, and I've been very curious about this mystery bird illness myself. And so early spring out east, a number of states were noticing and getting reports of bird mortalities that symptoms were swollen and crusty eyes and a neurological side effect like seizures or a lack of coordination. And testing began on some of those specimens, and they have still yet to identify what that illness is. So they've ruled some things out. Like if you think about the finches and the salmonella that you might hear about around bird feeders or conjunctivitis, all of that was ruled out. And so in talking with the specialist, she was saying that it does appear that out east and even closer to home, I believe Indiana, Ohio, reports have subsided, and that very well could be because of the reduction of or people helping, like your sisters, where they're reducing or eliminating, removing bird baths and bird feeders, and that maybe that has helped slow the spread. Or whatever the illness is or what the cause is, you know, going away. And so we still don't have that answer. To my knowledge, there's been no reports in Wisconsin. There's certainly, because of this awareness, people are reporting dead birds. But from what I understand, they don't have the symptoms we're looking for with this mysterious illness. So again, reporting birds that you see that have swollen and crusty eyes or neurological, they're either having seizures or they're very uncoordinated in your yard, then it's time for you to report it to your local DNR conservation biologist. So again, going to the DNR website and looking for that information. It's going to get close here to the time where people really do start feeding come winter. And so really just concerned about good hygiene practices around your bird feeders. So every now and then you want to empty those feeders, sweep away any of the fallen or spilled seed. You want to clean with a 10% bleach solution, so one part bleach mixed with 9 parts of water. Rinse those feeders thoroughly, and ideally let them dry in the sun before you refill them. And also, if you're going to have a bird bath, you want to clean that every day or two, especially with the warm weather, and just monitor the birds coming. So I think it would be okay to put those feeders back out, but again, with caution and monitoring in place.
Larry, can I add something to that really quick?
Sure.
Yeah. So everything Jamie said is absolutely correct. The only thing I'll add is nobody knows exactly why this is occurring or what the cause of it is. But the leading theory is that it has something to do with the cicada outbreak that occurred out east, because they were starting to see, as the cicadas were emerging and increasing in density, they were starting to see more and more birds get affected. And then as the cicada outbreak has kind of died off, or subsided, the bird health issues have also subsided. So the leading theory is that they think it has something to do with the cicadas. They're just not quite sure what. And they think it either might have something to do with, as the cicadas emerged, birds started feeding on them, and the cicadas had a fungus on them that affected the birds. And or because the cicadas have been underground for 17 years prior to emerging, that they've concentrated pesticides in their body. And as birds ate the cicadas, then they got pesticide poisoning. Again, there's no definitive idea about what exactly has caused the problem, but those seem to be the leading theories right now.
Interesting. Well, thanks again for that question, Dave. Appreciate it. Larry in De Pere, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Larry.
Hello, and thank you for your program.
Sure.
I just have a very simple question. In Burnett County, northwestern Wisconsin, has anybody reported any sightings of golden eagles? I know that they're not indigenous to this area, but I swear the eagles that we've been seeing up there on occasion are so much larger and do not have the white head than a standard American eagle.
Yeah.
So, Larry, I'll be happy to take that. And you're correct. We're on the eastern edge of the Golden Eagle Range. So where we do get sightings of golden eagles in Wisconsin. They tend to be on the western side of the state, those sightings when they come in. I'm sure you are aware that the bald eagle, it takes about 4 years before they get that mature white feathering on their head. So, you know, eagles, even the immatures, they're pretty impressive birds. It's possible you're seeing an immature, but I would not rule out the possibility that it is a golden eagle. And again, I'll reference you back to Wisconsin eBird. It's just a great resource where people are reporting their sightings. And then other, you know, more experienced birders are coming in and confirming those sightings. But if you go to Wisconsin eBird and you type in, get narrowed down to the state of Wisconsin and type in golden eagles, you can see where those reports have come in the past year. And maybe there have been some in your area.
Very cool. Thank you, Larry. Appreciate the call. Russ in Belleville, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a Purple Martin landlord here in Belleville. We got to put up a house in the village park and got 5 out of the 14 compartments filled, which was very satisfying.
That's awesome.
But now the birds have moved down on. And I remember last year there was a huge splash in the news about hundreds of thousands of Purple Martins gathering in downtown Nashville. I'm wondering if you know of any gatherings of that size or places near Wisconsin where there might be a known place where they stage or roost as they start their journey south to Brazil.
I don't personally have any knowledge of that. And you know, even though it occurs in Nashville, it could just be a kind of a coincidence more than anything else, because again, you know, they're following set migration routes. I mean, they're following, we have different migration pathways throughout the United States, depending on where you're located. But so they're following relatively set migration routes, and they also are feeding on the wings. So wherever the food is, that's kind of where they're going to concentrate. So, you know, those concentrations could move around geographically. So I don't know offhand, but it is awesome that you got Purple Martins. And to go back to some of the calls we've had, we've already had two calls about English or house sparrows, and we referenced the fact that English or house sparrows are not native to the United States. That's an example of where they will occupy Purple Martin houses and not let our native Purple Martins actually nest in those houses that are meant for Purple Martins. So that's an example where these non-native species can outcompete the native species and actually do some detriment to them. So that's great that you had Purple Martins that fledged out of your house this year.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot for that call. Well, let's see. We've got Katie in Fond du Lac. Hi, Katie.
Hi there, Larry. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's a great show.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I live in a very downtown area in Fond du Lac, and there was a sharp-shinned hawk that nested and fledged babies in my neighborhood on the top of a very tall spruce tree down my street. And I was wondering, does this happen very often in an urban environment?
David?
I'll take that really quick. Yes, sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks. And Larry, there's an email about a picture of a Cooper's hawk. Sharp-shinned hawk and Cooper's hawks are very common in suburban, urbanized type areas because they eat other bird species. And so that you'll find them frequenting backyards and areas where you have bird feeders because those bird feeders are concentrating things like sparrows and juncos and robins and all sorts of other types of backyard feeder birds. And those Cooper's hawks and sharpshin hawks come through that bird feeder, just like it's a McDonald's drive-through, and will pick up a meal. And so a lot of times, quickly, I know we're on a break here, Larry, we get calls saying, hey, we've got Cooper's hawks at our feeder, or sharpshin hawks at our feeders. What can we do? We said our natural response is, well, it is a bird feeder. And that's what they're yep. doing there. They're feeding just like the seed feeders are doing.
And I can remember a couple of years back walking along on the UW-Madison campus, and there was a sharpshin eating a bird about 3 feet off the sidewalk.
Yep.
So it'll happen. Well, I tell you what, David Drake and Jamie Nack are guests today, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. But we need to take a quick look at the news, and we need to find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. You can still email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking wildlife with our regular guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Jamie, an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David's an Extension Wildlife Specialist and a professor as well, both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecologist on UW-Madison campus. So, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email, maybe with a question or even a photo as well, to ideas@wpr.org. And, David, you mentioned just sort of in passing the photo that we got from JT in Menominee wondering if the three birds in the photo, it's a really cool photo, actually, are Cooper's hawks or not.
Yes, they look like Cooper's hawks, and for the listeners who can't see that, it looks like there's probably the mom and two or three juvenile Cooper's hawks, which is a little unusual to have that many juveniles, so they might be actually adults, but they're on their driveway, and a couple of them are just kind of laying down, flushed out with their wings out, just kind of sunning themselves and hanging out. So it's kind of an interesting picture to see. They do look like Cooper's hawks. Cooper's and sharpshin hawks, especially as they're flying, and if you only see one of them, even experienced birders, you can get, you know, 10 experienced birders, and five of them would say that's a Cooper's hawk, five would say that's a sharpshin hawk as that bird flies through. But in this particular picture, I believe that the Cooper's hawks, the Cooper's are typically larger than sharpshin hawks, although, again, it's hard to sell. It's to say size is relative. But I'm looking at the tail, and the edges of the tail on Cooper's hawks tend to be more curved or rounded, where the sharpshin hawk is more of a squared off tail. And then you can also look at the size or the relative width of that terminal white band on the tail. But in this picture, it does look like they are Cooper's hawks.
Yeah, I thought it was a Cooper's hawk. They were Cooper's hawks right away. And basically, the tail was what was the tail for me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but JT, thanks for sending that photo. Appreciate it. Elizabeth in Columbia County, your turn. Hi.
Yes, hi. I was just getting back to you about the European goldfinches.
Yeah.
From what I have seen on eBird and some of the Facebook birding pages, they've become pretty endemic along the Lake Michigan lakeshore, north of Milwaukee, even somewhat south of Milwaukee. I've seen reports of people kind of knowing that they habituate bird feeders at Harrington Beach State Park, and they're year-round, I think, now. So Oak Creek wouldn't be much of a stretch, I guess, from what I've been hearing about their particular situation.
Oh, Elizabeth, thanks. I did not know
Elizabeth,
that.
Thanks for calling back in and sharing what you have found. And I'm really glad to see that you were able to get on eBird and explore that data a little bit. So, yeah, thanks for sharing.
Much appreciated.
All we need is another non-native species.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Well, let's see. Charlotte in Rhinelander. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let you know that I've had two affiliated woodpeckers at my suet recently. One is an adult male. The other one is an immature female, and he actually feeds her.
Oh, very cool. Oh, did you get your camera out to get some footage of that, Charlotte?
I wish I had it. It's so exciting to see them at all, and then to see the dad feeding the baby. That was really great.
Oh.
I feed my birds. I don't have bird feeders as such. I have a deck, and I sprinkle seed on the deck railing, which I think prevents disease, too. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think you're probably right, Charlotte. If you're spreading it out, it's no different than baiting and feeding of deer. You're spreading out their potential for contact. The only downside I see about not using a designated feeder is if that seed is more available for other animals that you really don't want to start to encourage, whether that be a raccoon climbing your deck or, you know, some folks enjoy feeding squirrels, others do not, but squirrels would also have access. So if that's not a concern or is happening, by all means, continue to do it. But that would be a potential problem I could see in the future, is just other non-targets getting access to that seed and leaving feces or, you know, getting into other, causing damage around the home. So that would be the reason not to.
Yeah, the other issue is potentially mold growth, because that seed is now exposed to the weather, whereas if it's in a contained bird feeder, it's a little bit more protected. So just if the seed starts getting moldy, like Jamie said, you also want to clean that up as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Charlotte. Appreciate it. Rich in La Crescent, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, this is in regard to hummingbirds. We've been feeding a huge amount of them, and most of them left today. But my real question is, they will drain two hummingbird feeders every day. That's a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
Are we doing them a favor, or are we harming them, letting them eat so much that sugar water?
Well, I think they still, you know, most birds are going to feed on a natural source of food. You know, so first of all, the birds that use supplemental feed or feeders are a small percentage of the birds that we have in the state. And even those birds, if they can find a natural food source, they'll move towards it. So you may notice sometimes in the summer, your hummingbird feeders become very inactive. And it's likely the time period where they have the nestlings and they're really focused on an insect, high-protein diet. So you can see changes at your feeder as well. So I try to encourage people to keep their hummingbird feeders up through mid to end of September, because we do have birds migrating and having what we call stopover habitat or refueling resources is really important. And so I'd continue to keep, even though you feel like they've left, you may have some more north of you that are still going to come through in the next week or so. And it wouldn't be a bad idea to keep that nectar there. They have such strong internal instincts that they're going to continue to migrate. That's going to overpower, in most situations, the desire to stay because there's a food source, especially as the temperatures get colder here too. So,
yep, there you go. Thank you so much, Rich. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Paul in Boulder Junction. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Larry. I have hopefully an interesting eagle story that happened this past week. Some canoeists came and interrupted dinner on our deck in Vilas County overlooking a lake and said they had a wounded eagle on an island and needed help. And they had already called a raptor center in Antigo and said, we need a blanket and couple pair of leather gloves. Mm-hmm. So we went out to the island, and I was able to locate the eagle and trap him between the island and the water, throw the blanket over him, which, if anybody ever tries this, an eagle can bite right through a leather glove, which I was a victim of. And we wrapped him up, and we took him. He eventually ended up in Antigo at the Raptor Center, only to subsequently die, but post-mortem. A couple lessons learned on this for fishermen, conservationists. Postmortem showed he had a treble hook in its throat.
Oh.
And broken jaw because of wrapped fishing line, which the treble hook was associated with, and he broke his own jaw, they figured, trying to get it off. But another interesting point was, as the eagle was wounded sitting on this island, he was punctured, they thought, by another eagle or numerous eagles. So he wasn't going to survive no matter what, because they found numerous puncture wounds into his body, which I don't understand eagle behavior. But the next day, my wife and I were out on the lake, and they have a two-year-old fledgling that they had. Now it's only got one parent. And they follow me around, and I throw them hookless fish. And so one of the remaining parents followed me, and as I was throwing in a fish, there were four new eagles hovering over the lake. Question arises, are eagles that territorial that they would kill one of their own, or would its partner kill a wounded partner? So a couple interesting points.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. What do you guys think? You know, if the other animals, I know this is true of some animal species, if there's one that is injured, sometimes from their own species, they will dispatch that injured animal.
Yeah, that's true, Larry. And I don't know specifically behavior of eagles. I can think of no one else other than where you took the eagles. So the Raptor Education Group in Anago, what a great facility.
Oh, and wonderful.
Marge Gibson's wonderful, and she would be a really good one. You've already started a conversation with her to maybe ask a bit about more about that those injuries and why they may have been caused. But you're correct. Sometimes, you know, species do attack or see injury or illness, and will kind of pick or badger that individual. So great story. Really appreciate you getting involved and trying your best to help in an unfortunate ending, but a good educational lesson and something that you can share with others. And being careful about fishing line waste or lead in the environment too is something that we often talk about with eagles and loons and so on.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Todd in La Crosse next. Todd, hi.
Hello. Hi, thanks. We have had whippoorwills in our area for years, but not this year. The forest is still there. I wonder if you could comment on their status and, you know, what they really need for habitat to thrive.
Sure.
I'll take this, sure. Whippoorwills, depending on where you are in the state, can be relatively common still. But in other parts of the state, the population has declined. Overall, whippoorwill populations have declined throughout their entire range. And it has primarily to do with habitat loss. And whippoorwills like forested areas that have open understories. And so as you've suggested, that the forest is still standing where you are. So it doesn't sound like it's a habitat issue. The issue this year, I live in Madison, the Madison area, but I think for the most part, the state was relatively dry this year. And, I didn't see animals that I normally see simply because I think it was so dry that they moved around other areas where either the food was available or the water was available or whatever the case is. And if the habitat is still standing for the whippoorwills where you are and you typically see them, but you didn't see them this year, this is simply a guess, but I would attribute that probably to the drought-like conditions that we had, and perhaps the whippoorwills went someplace else for food or whatever the case is that they were looking for. Maybe the conditions just weren't right in that forested area where you typically see them.
All right. There you go, Todd. Thanks much for calling. Let's take another call. Rick in Vulcan, Michigan, your turn. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Well, good. I've got a kind of a unusual behavior that I've been watching for the last 4 years near my bird feeder. I cut off a 4-inch pin cherry tree that was blocking my solar panel on the upper end of it, and that was about 4 years ago. And since then, I've got red and white-breasted nuthatches, chickadees, downy woodpeckers, red squirrels, chipmunks, all coming to that cutoff four-inch pin cherry stump, essentially, to eat something. And they don't destroy it. The woodpeckers, the squirrels, none of that happens. But it appears to be like a mold growing on it, and so I've termed it the neighborhood bird pharmacy. It's almost as if they're eating some kind of, drug that they're getting from, penicillin or whatever it may be. I don't know, but I just wonder if anyone's ever noticed or watched it. This goes on every day. Constantly, there's a bird sitting on that stump, which is about 6 feet off the ground. It's not right on the ground. I even witnessed a red squirrel carrying a dead chickadee. I don't know if the squirrel killed the chickadee or not. And it's another weird behavior. But the red squirrel hauled the chickadee to the top of that stump and draped it on the top. And then it fell down. The squirrel went back down, got the chickadee, and put it back up there, and it sat up in that stump for like 3 days until it finally fell back to the ground, as if the red squirrel was protecting that. Now, this is kind of weird, but this is true.
Yeah, well, that's a good story, that's for sure, Rick. Get some comments. Jamie, why don't you chime in?
Yeah, Rick, I really have... no, like, clean, clear answer to just the species diversity that you're witnessing as well. But I do suspect that it has something to do with it being a perch site. It's still near your feeders. It's still this great place for the birds to come through your yard and stop and pause and check things out. So it's like this, location, a lookout location for them. That must be fairly attractive. My guess would be if you put a few more locations or created a few more places like that, it would be kind of the same thing where they're coming through. It's a place to land and perch. It's near your bird feeder. Squirrels like to have something to climb up on, sit on, to groom themselves. They don't usually do that straight on the ground. They're usually perched on something or up on a branch. So I feel like they're seeing it as a structure to perch or roost on temporarily. I don't know if you've witnessed them when you talk about maybe the mold. Are they actually, do you see them gleaning or, cleaning their bill or actually appear to be eating something, or are they just perched there?
Eating it. And, I agree. It is a focus point. The birds do stop there. And that would lead me to believe that the red squirrel is trying to protect the sunflower seeds by putting this warning up there. the nuthatches and the chickadees, they pound on that stump, and they're breaking pieces off. It's still intact. I mean, a woodpecker could take that stump apart in minutes if it wanted to. But they just peck at it, and they do land there. But they also just they're constantly pecking when they're sitting on it. Not always, especially the nuthatches. They just they sit and peck. And I've looked. I climbed up. It's about 6 feet off the ground, and I've put a ladder up, and I look at the structure of that pin cherry tree, and it looks like some kind of moldy, like something's growing on it.
Yeah, it could be, sap, or they're feeding on insects that are feeding on some of the, this is all part of the decay process. Having snags is super important to wildlife and for all the reasons or things that you're observing. So,
yeah,
very cool.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. There's one thing that I wanted to mention before we're done. We're going into the weekend, Labor Day weekend, and I know a lot of people are getting out for boating and so forth, and the DNR put something out today about wearing your life jacket, and just a personal story, a guy that I fished with for 25 years, about this time of the year, several years back, Jerry fell out of the boat. He didn't have his life jacket on, and he was a really good swimmer. But before his partner could get to him, he drowned.
Wow.
And it was a guy I've fished and hunted with for all those years, and a very strong swimmer. But the It's a reminder to me every time I get in a boat. Put your life jacket on and use that life jacket. So that's my little sermon for the day. I want to also, but something, remember that when you get out on the boat this weekend. A listener sent a photo, a water photo, kind of. David, the person is wondering if we got snow geese there or if we got swans there.
Yeah, I looked at that. It certainly looks like swans. It's hard to tell what kind of swan. We have three different species of swans in Wisconsin: mute swans, which are not native to Wisconsin, tundra swans, and trumpeter swans, which are native to Wisconsin. So those are definitely swans. It's hard to tell whether it be tundra or trumpeter. It is one of those two species. Typically, the trumpeters are bigger than the tundras, but the tundras are more common, and they look somewhat alike. The way you would typically tell them apart is a good majority of the tundras have a yellow spot or a yellow dot in front of their eye. But with this picture, it's hard to tell because the swans are a little bit too far away. It's hard to tell if I can't see a yellow dot in front of those eyes, but it's a swan for sure. It's not snow geese. And it looks like to be one of the two native species of swans we have in the state of Wisconsin.
And I want you to put in a plug right here, right at the end for the trapping segment that you want to do in the Madison area or in Madison itself.
Yeah, I sure will. Thank you, Larry. So again, this was mentioned earlier in the show, but this is part of our larger UW Urban Canid project where we live trap and radio collar coyotes and red fox. But we're interested in looking at the food sources that these animals actually eat. And so we're interested in if you are living within the Beltline in the Madison area, if you would be willing to let us come out and trap small mammals and sight rabbits on your property. Small mammals would include anything from chipmunks to rats to squirrels to mice and things like that. If you would allow us to trap small mammals and sight rabbits on your residential property in Madison, if you live within the Beltline, please email me at ddrake2@wisc.edu, or easier, just look up David Drake, University of Wisconsin, and you should find my contact information that way. But thank you very, very much.
Well, I tell you what, thank you, David, and thank you, Jamie. It's always fun to have you come by. I know Scott Craven will probably be back the first Wednesday of next month, but we'll see the two of you in, oh my goodness, November? Or is it October? Yeah.
Shocking.
Shocking. Yeah. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Jamie Dack, David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and also with the UW Extension Division as well. Great to have them with us. They'll be back. Tomorrow we'll talk about class action cases, insurance issues. We'll take a look at other legal questions as well. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. But in the meantime, there's lots more in store right through the afternoon. I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.